Just a quick warning, this podcast series contains discussions about crime, trauma, sexual abuse, drug use, and suicide. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome back to The Stick Up. Today, we're delving deeper into Loretta Lyon's extraordinary journey. Last week, we left her in the clutches of human traffickers after fleeing war. Now, witness her remarkable courage and resilience as she breaks free once again, embarking on a journey to safety in the UK as a political asylum seeker.
Okay, let's progress on. What was the next step here?
Oh, the next step, to make the whole long story short, actually, guys, because it is very, very long and detailed. They got to the point where they thought I had enough training and I should be efficient enough to serve the highest bidder. So they had put me to the highest bidder and I got bought by someone. I never met my highest bidder. And I was meant to then, they were meant to send me to Albania. And that's where the transfer would happen to the rest of the whatever was meant to happen to me. During the process of going to the border with Albania, Kosovo, we had to stop a few times and we reached the border eventually. The patrol at the border, it was Italian police officers actually guarding that border. They said the border is shut for today and we don't know when it's going to open, so we suggest to go back. The guys got really angry and they were holding guns at me, like, don't say anything, don't even try to flinch. Because for me, had there not been guns, I would have screamed. At least the police would have heard, and then they would have searched and realized I was being held against my will. But it was impossible, because had I done, they would have killed me. They would have killed everyone there. They had loads of guns in the car. Actually, sorry, Russell, before we got to the border, I just remember I forgot to mention something quite significant, which was quite weird with the boss. Before he wanted to hand me over, we went to this house, this apartment, and him and I spent a night together in this apartment. He opened red wine. He offered me. I was like, I don't drink. And I was so scared of him, because right now it was just him and I, not his guys, not his lover there, just him and I. And he said to me, he said, over the last few weeks with you, I've grown some feelings for you. And can you imagine? I'm listening to this, like, this monster is telling me he's got feelings for me. And he said, if you give yourself to me tonight willingly, meaning give my virginity, sleep with him, he said, then you'll be mine and you will not end up in, being sold to the highest bidder, and you will not end up in prostitution. Because they told me when I was with them, they said, you know, they were communicating. We were always together. They're like, oh, wait and see, you know, we sold it to the highest bidder. Then you go into prostitution. Then when you are done, then we take the organs. So nobody escapes us. And this was like really heavy psychological kind of content to process. Like, wow, my life is over. I thought it was over. So when the boss offered for me to be his, it was a way out, but there was no way I could find it in my heart to say, oh yeah, take me. I'm all yours. I refused. He still took me to bed. He laid next to me, tried to persuade me with weird acts and stuff. And I was just like, disgusted by him. In the end, he managed to do what he needed to do, but not spoiling me, just literally next to me. And he said, I'm so disappointed in you, because had you had given yourself to me, none of this will continue. You'd be mine. And I started crying. He said, go wash yourself. You disgust me. So I went and I washed myself and got ready. Then we went to the border and then we got returned. They said, you can't cross the border. Off you go. And the boss didn't know when the border is going to be open. So we went back to the safe house. But through the process of going from the border to the safe house, it took over an hour, like 2 hours max, or maybe minimum. He had to stop in a few different places to do business. He had some meetings and stuff, all like pizzeria, like pizza places and stuff. And I thought, oh gosh, what could I do to like cause some kind of a scene? So I said, I need to go to the toilet. And I would just stand up and walk off. And they would all panic. And then two guys would follow me, and I would go straight to the bar to say to the barman, you know, something's not right, but they wouldn't let me. So I would make them push me around so the barman could see I wasn't okay. when I think people start noticing that I was really being pushed around a lot, a young kid, someone along this journey must have either called the police or said something, because by the time you reached the safe house, the boss got a call. And I remember we literally just walked into the safe house. It was midnight, almost midnight by that point. And I remember him on a hallway on the phone, blank faced, looking at me, staring with death stare, and talking to these people on the phone saying, okay, right, okay, an Albanian. Okay, guys, you come here. We are going. You rape her, kill her, do what you wish. She's not worth it. She's more trouble than she's worth it. And now my time has gone from hopefully escaping to literally, oh my God, I am dying any minute. This was quite stressful moment for me because I knew I was dying. So I started panicking. I started crying and begging for my life. They left. They closed the doors. Prison door from the outside, wooden door from the inside. And this guy that was left with me is like, okay, right, okay, I need to do this. And I was speaking to him in Albanian. I said, look, please, you're going to do this. I can see that. Please let me pray. I just wanted to pray. I don't know what got into me. I wanted to pray because I was so scared of dying. And he actually granted me that wish. He said, okay, we'll pray. I'll respect that. I'll go wash myself. We'll pray together. I think I was his first kill to be. And he went to the bathroom and I'm there praying on the floor like Muslims do. I didn't even clean myself or anything. I Russell, everything went out of the window. There was no ritual there. I was crying for my life. I was thinking my mom and dad are never going to see me. They're never going to know what happened to me. And the last thought I had in my mind was, as I was praying, if only I could tell my mom and dad that I'm about to die and that I'm dead. So they know, then even if I die, it's okay. At that point, I just heard this cling on the table. And the guy, there was a glass table there, like a coffee table on my left-hand side. And there was a TV next to me. I turned around to look and I could see the gun and the keys. I can't make this up. It was just horrific. Like, I'm like, I got to do something. The guy went to wash himself. I thought, okay, I got to do something here. So I saw he's not there. I grabbed the keys. I looked at the gun. I'm not touching the gun. I'm a kid. I don't know how to use a gun. Neither am I a killer. So two keys and I'm looking at them, one long, one short. Okay, like, okay, I'll work it out. I go to the door and it was all a very small apartment. So it wasn't like huge space. He's washing himself, doing something. And I'm there at the door. I open the first door, the wooden door, no noise, nothing, perfect. When I went for the second door, I didn't realize that the metal doors with rails, you have to open them the opposite direction. So I was opening this way and the key wouldn't open. And I'm thinking, well, it's the only key. Surely this should be open. And I was like fiddling with it. And all of a sudden, as I'm fiddling and I'm like panicking and I'm shaking it and the door opened. So much so that he opened towards the outside and I almost went flying onto the, you know, the next sets of stairs. And I just started running down the stairs as fast as I could. It was on the fourth floor and I'm just like running down the stairs. I could hear footsteps. He's screaming and shouting behind. He had obviously noticed I'd gone. He's grabbed the gun. As I reached the main door, and the main door wasn't even a door, it was just open. He punched me so hard, I went flying onto the main road in the night. It was fairly quiet, hardly any cars. There was no cars at that moment in time. But as I lie there on the floor, because I've been hit so badly, I went flying. I'm turning around to get up, still thinking of escape. I see flashing lights of this big Jeep. And I thought, oh my God, in my head, this is a police officer. I recognized it straight away. And the lights were on. He was parking. I could see the brake lights. And I just started screaming at the top of my lungs. The police officer, he was finishing his shift. He saw that I was in distress. So he started coming towards me. And the guy started shooting at the police officer. So obviously a police officer pulled the gun and started shooting at him. So they both shooting. I'm crawling.
And you're on the ground, yeah?
I'm on the ground. I'm crawling towards the police officer at this point. And when I reached him, he grabbed me, he dragged me behind another parked car, behind his car, opened the door. He stopped shooting. He reached for the walkie-talkie thing that was connected to the car. He said something. I just remember seeing I remember his face vaguely, but I remember the flag. It was Italian flag. Mm. So he happened to be an Italian police officer that rescued me in this moment in time. And within not even a minute, it's too long, seconds, I don't know how many United Nations police cars reached our point. Translators, this, that, a lot was happening. He's then telling them it's over there, the apartment. I'm telling them in Albanian, it's over there, fourth floor. Maybe he's gone there. You know, I'm just trying to help. But I'm also angry at everyone because it's like, where are you guys? Why are you not searching everybody? Yeah. In my head, I've got this anger. Yeah. And I was like, don't touch me. I became from really scared to complete anger management issues.
Yeah.
And they're like, okay, calm down, the translators. Let's take you to the police station. Took me in, and at the police station, I gave a testament who they were. Yeah. I described them. This Albanian Kosovan guy approaches me with a uniform. He's a police officer. And he started crying. He said, can I hug you in Albanian? I said, please don't touch me.
Yeah,
you know, Russell, it's just
become so badly desensitized.
Yeah, it's like, you know? Exactly. It's like, do not. And I know he meant well. Mm. I said, don't touch me. He said, no, I want to hug you. And he was my dad's kind of age. Mm. He said, you are the only survivor that has survived these guys, because we've been wanting to put them in prison for so long now. We know what they are doing, but we don't have anyone testifying against them. So you're the only one. I said, here's the testimony. I don't care. I'm done. They're like, no. You need to appear in court. You need to appear in Hague. They're going to be sent to Hague. And I'm like, Hague? Where is Hague? What's Hague? I said, I don't want anything to do with this. Here's the testimony. They said, okay, but where are you going to go? It's 3 a.m. in the morning. So a lot of time has passed. By the time I finished my interview, I said, I have two American police officers, Peter and Brian. Gave them their full names. And they obviously knew them straight away because unit number and stuff. They came up on the system and called. They called them on the phone. They woke them up. Peter answered the phone. He said, I'm waiting by the gate. I'm by the main door for her. And they approached. We approached the door. Peter was waiting there. He grabbed me so tight. He hugged me, started crying. Brian, you know, just the whole thing. That was my reunion with my two American police officers. But I had to leave. I couldn't stay there. So,
wow, what a story. Like, wow. What was that, the catalyst? Like, I know when it comes to sort of giving that evidence against them, there's a lot of energy it takes, you know, and there's a lot of trauma, and there's that you're badly desensitized and you're disassociated. And I think the act of having to give evidence takes you back to the scene, doesn't it?
It really did, Russell. I was so raw and I was angry. So angry. It's like, what's going on? All this United Nations and you can't even see it. Something's going wrong. I was so angry. Because
it was under their nose. It was just
It was just under. I didn't understand it.
They're brazen. Hey, them people. They're so brazen. It's like, you know, I had a documentary being filmed about me, and I was about to go to where and a bunch of pedophiles contacted the TV station and tried to get it stopped. But they wouldn't go on camera and say what they had to say. They said, oh, no. And I was telling them, I said, this ain't right. These people are pedophiles that are trying to get you to stop it. They're so fucking brazen.
I have said it so many times. May God be with anyone that I catch hurting a child.
Yeah.
I don't think I could control myself. And this is not a threat. I'm just making a statement. Yeah. I, with all the martial arts in the world that I know that teaches you to control yourself, I find somebody hurting a child, I don't think I can promise them to control myself.
I've seen one happen in Sydney. And this guy was being sexually abused by pedophile rings. And when he killed two of them, and he killed them, but he done really bad. He dismembered them and everything like that. And he got never to be released. He got stamped never to be released from prison because it was so barbaric. But I was thinking, no one asked him, what were you going through to do that? what happened to you? What happened to you? Because these people brutalized this kid, desensitized him, disassociated him, robbed him of everything. And when they act out, we're gonna punish you again. We're gonna put you in prison, which is just a trauma pit. We're just gonna keep that trauma happening for you. It's crazy.
I don't think there is such. I don't think any government has such a system where rehabilitation is put in place.
And in your case, like because of the borders and everything like that, there would have been jurisdiction problems, like in the areas that you were in.
It was, but they're all so connected. It's so corrupt.
It is so corrupt.
And these guys, I think the human trafficking, they were.
They're politically connected and all that too, aren't they?
So corrupt, yeah.
Yeah.
It was, I think that's why they never went. They went to prison. They got out claiming they're not well or what have you.
Doesn't that kill you? Where I'm not well, I'm mentally unwell. You're fucking mentally, look what you've done to me.
But this is why I'm just trying to sort of raise awareness and hopefully, not educate, but just inform the public that these kind of things, because a lot of people have messaged me, it's like, are you serious? This happens? I'm like, it does on a daily basis. I mean, 150 million people get trafficked every year. And some for all sorts of, some for sex, some for organ harvesting, children, obviously, with all these slave different labor. Rituals and stuff. It's sick.
Yeah.
Because I'm working with different agents now and they tell me, and honestly, I'm losing sleep sometimes because it's quite disturbing.
When you hear them, like I'm in a similar place with the work I do. How do you cope with that? What's the coping mechanism you use? Because when you hear a story, I learn a way to not visualize it. I only heard it in words. But that stopped working for me because I went back to seeing what was happening. And I was watching a nightmare. It's not good for me. And I was waking me up at 2 o'clock in the morning seeing the nightmare again. How do you cope with that when you're working with these people? Like, does it trigger you?
I crumble every time. I can't sit here and pretend, because it's just not fair to give people false information and hope that, oh gosh, it goes away. It doesn't go away. You just become better at handling stuff.
Yeah.
But I really have been very affected with what I'm hearing, the children and to the point where, for example, an agent told me that when they rescue these kids, for example, in Africa, what happens is they rescue the kids, they take them to the safe house, which they've got these houses to rehabilitate the children. You have to imagine these kids have been gone missing since babies. That's all they know. Being raped 25 times a day, spending weekends with a white male stranger from Europe, being raped in a hotel room. I mean, Russell, I said to him, how you are a trained, he's an agent, he's served in the army, he's served in special forces. You having to pretend you are buying these children for yourself because that's how they rescue them. How can you? I said that you must be really strong to sit there and really pretend you are the buyer just to rescue the kids. He said, I have to. I have to literally pretend I am the buyer. And so when they take the kids and they take them to rehabilitation places, houses, kids sometimes run away because they think they're in danger with their safe house rather than
because that's
all they know.
Yeah.
How sad is that?
Yeah, that's that conditioning, isn't it? That's crazy.
It's absolutely monstrous. I mean,
tell me, how did you end up in, where did you go through from there? So you would have, you're 18, 19 by that stage?
I had just turned 18 during this time. And so, after I reunited with my American police officers, clearly it was made very clear to me I cannot be in Kosovo and certainly I didn't want to be in Kosovo anymore. I was disgusted what I witnessed. I wanted to run back home, same way as I came, and die with my family. I didn't know if they're dead or alive, but I just wanted to go back to war and die by a bullet or die by a bomb. I just didn't want to be there. So I said goodbye to Peter and Brian. It was really emotional, just saying goodbye to these guys. It was really tough and got on the way back home, made my way all the way near the mountains where I came down off. And then I looked around, nobody was around. So I climbed the mountain again and started trekking. When I reached our village, it was like a ghost town. that obviously there was smoke, and it was this feeling of like everybody's dead, because everybody was hiding either in shelters, underground, that kind of stuff. Not necessarily shelters, but what they considered to be a shelter. And so I went into our garden and I looked around and I was like, where is my mom and dad? I looked inside, they're not there. Lo and behold, they were hiding underground in this, we have a room underground where we keep wood and so on. It's like a basement. So I went down to the basement. As soon as I opened the door, my mom and dad were just there, like curled up and waiting for a bomb to hit them. They looked at me and my mom started panicking. She's like, why did you come back? I'm like, I have so much to tell you. I didn't care what would happen next. I just wanted to tell them that I was in danger. I escaped. I was so proud of myself at the same time that the love for them made me carry on so I could tell them. My mom was like, you're not supposed to come back. You don't know what's going to happen. People, they're searching for you. I'm like, who's searching? I'm like, what? My dad was like, oh my God. And then before they had time to tell me anything, this truck, the army truck. So in Serbia, during the war, the Serbian army was one thing. And then another army was formed during the war that they recruited prisoners of war, killers, rapists, to literally put on uniform. Identify them with trainers, you know, like Nike or something, Adidas, just white trainers. So they knew who was a real army and who wasn't. So they knew each other, but we started to know them as well. So when this truck pulled into my mom and dad's garden, the soldiers came out and they grabbed me. And we saw they were wearing trainers. Well, what can you do, Russell? You can't go against the army. My dad is crying, my mom is crying in the middle of the garden. And all I'm saying is like, mom and dad, don't worry. And now I'm speaking to them in Serbian. I said, I'm just going to explain what had happened in Kosovo. And they let me go. Yeah. It's fine. My mom is hysterical. My dad obviously is holding my mom. They put me in this truck and they start driving. I could see where we were going. It wasn't far. It was just the mountain that is still there. It's always there. And it was this abandoned building, what seemed like this. No one has ever worked in it or done anything for a long time, but there was few rooms. And they put me straight into the interrogation room. So two soldiers with me, and then there was one waiting there. The interrogation started by just asking me questions. Where have I been? What have I done? Why did I cross borders? And I just stayed to the story like I'm telling now. I said, you guys came, they wanted to do a massacre. So I was telling the whole story. I said, my dad panicked. He asked me to leave. And told them what happened in Kosovo. They still didn't believe it. They said, you are spying. I'm like, I was a spy in Kosovo, now I'm a spy in Serbia. I mean, come on, I'm only 18, for crying out loud. And they decided, they said, okay, she's not telling the truth. Let's beat her up. They started beating me up. I mean, I was unrecognizable by the time they got finished with me. They broke my nose. My teeth was just flying out of my mouth. I still have missing teeth. I never replaced it because, you know, it's some of the things you want to almost like cling on to remind you where it comes from. So weirdly. And ended up, the last thing I remember after them throwing me around for what seemed a lifetime, they said, okay, hold her down. Let's burn her, they said in Serbian. Burn me? I was thinking, I couldn't even see. My eyes got so swollen and I was bleeding everywhere. My nose was sideways. Teeth, what, like, you know how the teeth bleed when you take them out? It was streaming down my neck. And they held me down with my face down and I could feel something hot on my calf. And then I just felt the heat and I just blacked out because the intensity of the heat must have made me just pass out.
Were they branding you or something?
They branded me with this like a hashtag shape because I had it. I had it laser removed, but I had it on my calf for a long time, decade. And
what was that? What was the significance of that? What was the significance of them branding you?
That I would tell the truth.
Yeah.
There was no, I couldn't tell them anymore. I was telling the truth, but they thought I was lying.
Yeah.
So just abuse.
Yeah.
And so I blacked out, but then I woke up in this very small space. It wasn't even a prison cell because you know, we all know what the prison cells look like. This one was like as tall as I, when I stood up, I could almost touch the ceiling. I mean, with my head.
Yeah.
So as tall as I was, when I lied down, it was as long as I was. Mm. And then I could reach the other side. It was really small. It was like grave-like, what I describe it as. No window, but there was a door.
Yeah.
And it was concrete, nothing there, just a blanket on the floor. So I was literally on this blanket. I woke up, I couldn't see anything initially anyway because I was like blood and like swollen eyes. But my leg was throbbing and I started panicking because it was, even though when I started slowly opening my eyes, I could see there was nothing to see.
Mm-hmm.
I could see the crease, you know, when the door shuts and outside is light and you're in a really pitch black room, you could just make out like this line under the door. And I thought, oh no, I'm in a grave. Or I really started panicking, banging the door in pain, crying, screaming. And I thought this would end. This is going to take like 24 hours and it will end. Unfortunately, Russell, sorry to say this, guys, to the audience, it turned into an absolute nightmare. 6 months held. Like a wild animal, not even, I shouldn't even say that because you shouldn't hold anybody like that, but held in this small dark room for 6 months with no daylight, no proper conditions. I was rotting. I was, my wounds was rotting. I was getting, I was infected because they'd gotten all infected. I was very ill. They were coming in and out. They started raping me like daily. And not just one, all of them, and three at a time. And then once that happened, I thought, well, what's the point of me even trying to live, for crying out loud? What's the point? Now I'm completely degraded here. You know, I've just been raped by all these men. I have. Obviously, I couldn't see myself, but I knew I was. I looked like a monster. I was deformed. You can't live in those conditions. And I thought, what the heck am I doing? So I decided to starve myself. All that little soups they were throwing in when they remembered, I just refused to eat. That room became my toilet. Whatever I had, I was losing weight. Everything that was coming out of me. That was it. That was my toilet. That was my room. That was everything. Mm-hmm. Every menstrual cycle I received initially, it was all there in that blanket. And it was a mess. It was, I can't even describe the smells, the, and then I thought, okay, I'm just going to starve myself. And then, you know, I was ready to go. I was so ready to go. I thought.
Made peace with death.
Yeah, you just do. There's so much more you can do. It's like
I relate to. I spent 9 months in a black hole.
Yeah,
in prison 9 months. Yeah, but they used to open it up 1 hour a day so I could fight them. They wanted to test themselves on me to fight them. So that was entertainment. You know, I used to love it. I was like a caged animal. I'd come flying out of there and attacking them. You know, and then they'd cage me back in like some sort of lion. But and I. The thought process that goes on there with your mind, it's hard to slow your mind down.
It is
your mind, your thoughts. You just seeing your thoughts racing everywhere. Relate to it.
Well, you end up hitting the wall. You have. I mean, I ended up in that room doing all sorts of stuff, like scratching, hitting, wanting to die, wanting to bang my, you know, banging my head, banging everything.
Yeah, then you want to try bang yourself in your head. I've done that. Been for the stage. Bang your head, trying to knock yourself out. So you get some peace.
But going back to the beginning, you know when you said what happened to these people?
Yeah.
It's what saved me in these moments because I went from really feeling a victim and, degraded and destroyed and just like the body that we're using as and when they pleased. And I didn't even know why they wanted to be with me. I was, I looked horrific. I was like a monster. And then I thought, I learned this thing that now I know it's like meditation kind of thing where you have the outer body experience and I would just stare at the ceiling. You couldn't see anything anyway. Yeah. Or close my eyes and just think, oh, you know, nice music that I used to listen to, my mom's cooking, my childhood. Whilst they were raping me, I had to completely detach myself. Yep. So I don't feel the pain. I don't feel anything. Mm-hmm. And I wrestled with that, the more details of this complete madness. 6 months passed by. I didn't know it was 6 months, but then I worked it out. My dad told me. They came and they said, there is somebody here to see you. Like, I didn't believe them. I couldn't walk. I was skin and bones.
Yeah.
And I walked out and they dragged me to this room where my dad was.
Yeah.
And I heard my dad's voice. And when my dad saw me as a doctor, can you imagine seeing someone that is so unhealthy? His face just went pale. And I said to him, what took you so long, Dad? The first words I said to him in Albanian at this point. And they were like, stop talking in Albanian. You speak in Serbian. We want to understand. And then my dad said, okay, come on, let's go. And I said, what do you mean, let's go? What's happening? Is mom dead? I was thinking more about my mom. Mm. He said, no, I've just bribed you. We're going home. And when I walked out of that door of this building, I was so blinded by the bright light outside because I've been so encaged for so long. And I couldn't see. I closed my eyes. I said to my dad, I can't see. And he then realized, he didn't know my condition. So he realized I couldn't look at the sun or the light. So he put something over my head, a jacket. And then we went to the car. He put me at the back. I lied down. And I said, Dad, tell me, is mom dead? He's like, no, she's at home. She's waiting for you. Come on, we're going. I said, okay. So I just lied there and couldn't wait to get home. And we got home. Obviously, my mom was in panic. She can't hold her emotions. She's screaming and like, oh my God, what did they do to you? My dad is like, calm down. Let's just wash her. I need to dress her wounds and give her injections and she's infected. And so my dad gave me lots of medication, but I had to eat because they had to inject me and certain things you can't take in an empty stomach. I couldn't eat because I like was skin blades, and bones, literally. I was like a skeleton. And I lie down on the sofa and my mom is there on my mom's lap. And honestly, Russell, for the first time, I genuinely would have been happy if I just passed away then in my mom's lap. Because I was where I belonged. I was with them. They saw me. I was ready. I was drifting in and out of this deep sleep. And relief, sense of relief, you know, post-traumatic kind of relief. You know, when you're under so much stress, your body is in stress the whole time. And then you are here, you're like, oh. It's almost like, you know, I don't know how to explain it for people. If you've ever had a stressful day and then you have that sip of gin and tonic or wine and you're like, ah, oh. So that kind of feeling, just to make it more generic. And and my dad was whispering with my mom. He's like, it's time. And I'm like, time for what? Like, guys, please, it needs to stop. I can't do this. I don't have energy. I'm done. No, my dad said, one last thing. And then we know that you are done then. I was like, oh, my God. Another thing, Dad? He's like, yeah, last thing. And he said, for this, you really need to cooperate now, Loretta, because I said, Dad, they're going to kill you because you need to take me back. You told them you're bringing me back. You bribed me out. He's like, don't worry about it. You're going. He said, say goodbye to your mom because this is the last time you see us. It's like, seriously, you're both alive and I'm saying goodbye. I never thought I would see them again. And then my dad took me to this truck, walked slowly, put me in this truck. It was I think it's a Spanish driver. I couldn't talk to him, but I looked. I was like, oh my God, another man. You know, I was like terrified of everyone. I was so scared and so I lost all trust in humankind. My dad said, do this for us for the last time, please. He said, the driver knows what to do. You'll be fine. You don't need to communicate. I can't communicate with him either, but he's been told what to do. He's got instructions. and he said, kiss me goodbye. So I hugged him so much. And then I looked in the window on the mirror as we pulled away. And that was pretty much the last time I thought I'd see them. And then, you know, my journey to the UK became completely another story besides this book. You know, it was a journey to safety, which after a long time of traveling, I ended up in the UK as a political asylum seeker. And I'm grateful to the governments for giving me the second chance in life. Because sometimes the refugees can turn out to be good people.
Yeah, you are.
So heck of a journey, but sorry guys, I'm going to pull myself together.
It's just no, emotional. Please, it's all good. It's all good. This gives other people strength, you know, when they see people vulnerable and being seeing people authentic. And you know, you're right now, you're giving some young girl or some young boy or someone who's been through a really traumatic event, you're giving them strength through your vulnerability. And I think it's a real powerful. Really powerful thing, and it's nothing to do with pulling yourself together.
It's, Russell, you're right, because it's what you know. They say it worldwide. They say what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. 100%. I think this must come from these. But
the real strength, the real strength and growth comes from. Man, I was like violent. I was, you know, I was trying to kill myself. You know what I mean? And that was that whole thing. You know what I mean, I realized my real strength. I've always been a guy who's really physically active, and I used to think all my feats come from how fast I could run or how hard I could punch or how much weights I could lift. But my real strength comes from vulnerability, like you're just showing now, that authenticity and vulnerability. And I think more people need to get on in front of cameras and show this vulnerability. Right now, you're leading the way. Right now, you're a leader. You're a warrior.
Thank you, Russell. I just think be vulnerable with people you love. Don't pretend to be the tough guy or the tough girl. We all meant to share, and unless we are vulnerable, the loved ones are never going to know how to deal with us.
For sure.
Because if we bottle it up, I mean, initially when I met my husband, and this was just my boyfriend then, he didn't know my story, and he had no idea why was I having nightmares, why was I particularly the way I was, why was I set in certain ways.
Because you develop all different types of idiosyncrasies, don't you?
Exactly. Yeah. So until I knew he was proposing to me when I actually decided to tell him my story. Yeah. It's like, let's move in together and will you marry me? I was like... You need to know first who I really am. I realized it was important.
Yeah, for sure.
But sometimes I think people don't open up because, as you and I know, sometimes you feel ashamed of what had happened to you.
But here's another thing I draw back on. I often say, you know, perpetrator's greatest weapon is victim silence and shame, right? That's firstly. But we carry backpacks of stuff.
Yeah.
That weigh us down, that don't belong to us. And that shame we carry, where that shame's a fucking great torturer.
It is.
That shame and embarrassment, that guilt and the anger and the resentment will rust the vessel it's contained in. Having a resentment is like drinking a cup of poison and hoping the other person will die from it.
Yeah.
It doesn't work. It's not self-serving.
No.
I had a really good trauma counselor, and she said to me, and I remember I didn't even know her. I didn't even see her. I just spoke to her on the phone from prison. We used to speak once a week, once a fortnight. She said, today we're going to kill a pedophile. And I said, she said, so what's the plan? She goes, do you know where there's one in the prison? I said, yeah, I'll have to jump a couple of fences and then I'll have to get in the unit. And she said, how many other inmates in there? I said, 60. She said, how many of them will inform on you? I said, the whole 60, you know. And we'd done like a breakdown. So you've got to dispose of the weapon. You kill him. You've got to dispose of the weapon. You've got to get rid of the clothes. You've got to get back over the fences without fence. And what's the chances of getting caught? It's like about 190% chance of getting caught. What's the consequences of it? And the consequences, I'd get a mandatory 20 years in jail. What's the consequences to you? Well, I'd suffer dearly, even more, emotionally really traumatized by the act of prison. What's the consequences on your children? Well, they suffer and I open them, I create vulnerability for them, they'd be abused as well, so I can't protect them. Is it worth it? No, it ain't. So why do you keep thinking of it? Why do you keep hanging on it? You're hanging on to something that's just doesn't serve you. Let it go. It's hard. It's hard for you to let go of those resentments.
Yeah, I learned the only reason for me to let go was to forgive myself first.
100%.
These were the healing process was to really learn how to forgive myself and then start forgiving the initial people around me, like even people I didn't know, like on the tube, you know, sometimes like today I was so rushed and tube delays and stuff. So you get flustered and you run around. London is a big place. So if somebody like hit you by accident and they turn around and say, oh, what's your problem? F you, da, da, da. I used to react so quickly and say, oh, F you then, you know, just respond the same way. And then I thought, that's not really my way. So I learned to forgive them instantly. The forgiveness started with small things.
The gift you give to yourself.
Yeah.
Forgiveness is the gift you give to yourself.
Yeah. And then you realize you don't take anything with you, that you don't hold their baggage of hatred or anything, really.
Well, that's what you did in your life. In our lives, in your lives, in my life, I carried a backpack of things that just weighed me down. So when I talk about it and when I talk about my story, as you do now and as I do, we pull out the brick, and there's a brick and, you know, there's all different bricks with different labels on it. One's resentment, one's shame, and we're pelting it back at the perpetrators themselves saying, hey, you carry this, this belongs to you. It don't belong to me. I'm carrying something that don't belong to me, you know.
It's true. We end up carrying it sometimes for them.
But, you know, so tell us about what you're doing now. What's the work you're doing now? And I really want to talk about your book because I'm looking forward to it. I'll get that read between Dubai and Sydney.
Oh, brilliant. I can't wait to hear your reviews on that, Russell. Enjoy it. I mean, look, now that you've met me, you know I'm alive. I didn't want to do the book, but I started writing about what had happened to me. It was a therapeutic. It was very cathartic.
Yeah.
So I started putting things on down, thinking I would never look at it. It was just a download from my mind. When my mentor said to me, Loretta, you know what? He said, why don't you do a book? Because there is so much need to raise awareness on human trafficking and you never know who you're going to inspire and help. I was thinking, how is my story going to help anyone? He was like, trust me, it will. So I decided to publish the book.
Yeah.
I know.
Unbroken. Surviving Human Trafficking by Loretta Lyon. And just tell me quickly, how can we get this book?
The book is available on Amazon.
Yeah.
I self-published because...
How tough is that? I've done a book self-published.
Honestly, I just thought, you know what? I've done so much on my own by now. I might as well just do this as well. And I published on my birthday. I'm quite sentimental because I felt like it was a gift of life, kind of second chance in life. I wanted to inspire because my birthday has been quite something since I've been
born. You're alive. You're a survivor. Look at you go.
So, yeah, now just raising funds for charities, doing all that I can to raise awareness. Next steps, possibly soon, a documentary and a feature film.
Yeah,
so I'm really excited.
Play you? Who's going to play you?
We need to find
Julia Roberts, right, you know, a younger, you know.
We need to find an Australian actress. Why not?
The whole process of writing is, I've just signed a book deal myself. So
good.
So I'm about to do it. Yeah. And documentaries and stuff like that. And I get what you're saying. I love your story. I think it's one of the most powerful stories. It's just an amazing story. And we're a big team over there, like big survivor group types teams and advocates for child abuse and stuff like that. So, love to get you involved. We'd love you to come down and anything you can ever do, ever come to Australia.
I'd love to. I love Australia. Maybe I should just move.
Maybe. We'd love to have you.
I love Australia. I love Australian people.
Yeah.
I have such good memories. I did visit. I fell in love with the place. I went to Manly and there is a restaurant called Hugo's.
Yeah. Right on the wharf, yeah.
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 Jack's, Hugo's, there's so many. I was like, oh my God, all my kids' names are here.
Yeah.
So.
It's just that it's a good place, but we'd love to. And I think, you know, your story, you know, this story is so powerful. So powerful. And the way you articulate, and I think, you know, and the fact of you're comfortable in your vulnerability. And I think that's really, that for me, that's the ultimate.
Does. I just want your listeners to gain from this and go away and think, you know, how they can overcome that, whatever the obstacles are, challenges.
Yeah.
And if I could do it, you could do it, they can do it.
We can do it together.
I want this story to reach them with inspiration. I don't want anyone feeling sorry for me at all because I'm so grateful for what I went through. So I can sit here and share some lessons. And in fact, I didn't get to share a lot of lessons, but hopefully you can pick some stuff from it. If I'm coming to Australia this time, I don't think I'm coming back to Europe. I absolutely love Australia.
Come in the spring, you won't leave.
I love Australia.
And Australia will love you, I have no doubt, after watching this. Thank you. Hey, Loretta, thank you very much for being on the Stick Up podcast. And it's not – people go – you know what my mate Key pointed out? He goes, people think because I used to be a bank robber, it's the Stick Up isn't sticking up. He says, no, stick up for yourself. And that's what it is.
You got to, because you can't stick up for other people if you can't –
stick up for yourself.
Yeah, you got to. Prioritise.
Been an honour and a privilege having you here. What a pleasure.
Thanks for coming all the way to London.
Yeah.
No, it's been a pleasure. Such a privilege.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.